Welcome to Speaking with Authority. I'm very excited today to introduce our guest, Harry Campbell. Harry is an expert on leadership. He's got a great speaking business. He just does a tremendous job for companies getting out and speaking them, getting them a catalyst for change, for pursuing leadership. And he's just got a really powerful story. So I am so excited to introduce you to Harry Campbell.
Hey.
Harry, tell me about yourself. How did you get into leadership? Where did you come from? All this good stuff.
Through my business career, I've had the opportunity to first lead people back in the late 80s. I started at Procter & Gamble and spent 7 years with Procter & Gamble in marketing and had some leadership roles. And I learned to love it because I realized it could be a differentiator. It's fun. It's great to see people blossom and grow and become leaders themselves. But at the same time, I realized that if I try to figure out how to be a better and more effective leader myself, then I had the opportunity to win in the marketplace more. And I'm very competitive, so it worked very well. I came to Kansas City in 1992 to work for Sprint, and I've been here over 30 years in a variety of different roles with Sprint, Embark, DuraVision, Freightquote. The cool part about it is leadership continued to be something that I loved and tried to be very good at and tried to help other people be good at. And then when I get somebody that asks me to be on a podcast to talk about leadership, I jump at the chance and say, let's do it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, you started back and you were graduated from Vanderbilt?
So undergrad Vanderbilt, then went straight through for the next 2 years to Indiana to get my MBA.
Okay. And then where did you start your work?
Procter & Gamble in the summer of 1985. Spent 7 years at P&G. Extraordinarily cool experience for me. Mm-hmm. My parents were teachers, so I didn't have a lot of exposure to the business world. I was a history and economics major at Vanderbilt, so I didn't have a lot of exposure to business. Went and got an MBA, but I didn't have any work experience, so that the 2 years that I was in business school at Indiana getting my MBA was not as rich as it might have been if I'd had work experience. So then in 85, I showed up at Procter & Gamble, and that's when the fun began. I started learning about business. I started paying attention to leadership. And at that point, I came to the conclusion that if I did things right with regard to leadership and people, and that includes leading culture and leading the business and generating results, if I was able to do that, then what would happen is the competitive part of me would really shine and have the opportunity to win and potentially help more and more people to become better and better leaders, and it spirals upward in a good way.
I like that. I like that. So you were at Procter & Gamble for a while, then did you go directly to Sprint, or did you go, where did you go after that?
7 years at P&G and then directly to Sprint in the summer of 1992. And I was with Sprint for 5 years and smoking along and enjoying it and learning. I was a young vice president, and then I quit. And from the ages of about 35 to 40, give or take, I did a whole different thing that I never thought I would, which was try to become an entrepreneur.
Okay.
I always questioned whether I really was, because I define entrepreneurship by your risk profile. And I'm not a risky person by nature. What I like to do is I love to run organizations that are already launched and successful and operate them and lead them and develop them in ways that make them even better. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a person that's going to put the second mortgage on the house, eat ramen noodles, and try to be the business changer of the world. It's just not what I do, but I tried it. The first thing that I did was MAI, which was a sports marketing firm. I became a co-owner of that. A friend of mine had already started it, so it had 20 people when I showed up, and it was a cool experience. I'm a sports freak anyway. We were helping companies to grow their business by using sports, which was a marketing firm, but it was sports-oriented, and I loved it. We were extraordinarily successful because my partner had set up a very good company, and I was able to join that. We were at Corporate Woods. We won the Mr. K Award in 1998 as the Small Business of the Year from the Chamber of Commerce of Kansas City, and it was really cool. And then I made one of those decisions that in hindsight looks pretty bad. I sold my half of the company back to my partner because I decided to get into the dot-com world of 1999. It looked like it was going to go northeast, big wins, personally, professionally, this is going to be great. I did some house hunting trips to California, particularly to the San Francisco Bay Area with private equity firms. Didn't end up working for one of them. I ended up working and running a internet startup in Kansas City, which was great news because I didn't have to move my family out to the West Coast, because that company that I was with, UClick, which was a digital syndicator of content. So if you have a website, if you had a website and you wanted Doonesbury or Dear Abby or Garfield on your website, you bought it from me, and then I would give the share of money to the creator. Mm-hmm. So that's a syndicator. Unfortunately, we were eyeballs oriented with regard to revenue generation, and there just weren't enough people on the internet in 1999 and 2000, and we failed. So I went from having a very nice, successful vice president job and career at Sprint into a wildly successful and award-winning small business, feeling like, boy, business is working real well. Then the internet hit me, and that time with UClick was a great learning experience, but in many ways it was humiliating. I'd never failed that massively and publicly and spectacularly. It was tough. It made it so that I was in a position most people would not want to be. I was unemployed. I was divorced. I had a six-year-old and a four-year-old, and I was trying to figure out what life looked like, and I was close to 40 years old. Yeah. That was not the plan, in case you wonder what the plan looked like. It had nothing to do with that. The good news is I had left Sprint well. I told my kids, it's one of the things that I tell them is, if you ever leave a place, leave well. Mm-hmm. Transition if needed, help when possible. Do what you can when you say bye to be well thought of. I did that, and therefore Sprint took me back, and I then had a career in telecom with Sprint, followed by Embark. And things went extraordinarily well and ended up with some pretty big jobs there and having fun putting leadership principles into place, mentoring and coaching folks in my organization, but also applying some of the successes and failures I'd had previously in my career. And those years after 40 with Sprint and Embark were some of the best years of my life. I absolutely loved them.
That's great. Now, you know, we all as leaders go through challenges. You know, we go through difficult times. It's not just a bed of roses. In fact, life is a roller coaster. We go through this ups and downs. You know, is there any big aha moments you got out of your downtime before you, you know, personal growth things or things that were ahas that you wouldn't have learned any other way?
Yes. I'm going to give you two. And this is very stream of conscious, which is the fun part of doing question and answer sometime. I learned that success should never be taken for granted. I had had a lot of successes, and I think I was getting full of myself. And believing that I couldn't fail.
Yeah.
And I had been advancing monetarily and organizationally and in job titles, and life was very good until it wasn't. And when it wasn't, when I looked around and realized all that I had worked for with regard to the previous companies was now by the wayside, and I was unemployed, and I realized at that point that the hard work, the preparation, determination, and also others-oriented approach that I had taken my first 10 or 15 years, I needed to get back to the basics and do that. Because if I did that, I knew I could get back on track to win. But at that point, I was not on track to win. Mm-hmm. And I was in a very difficult situation, not enjoying myself, trying to figure out where I'm going to do, where I'm going to go, how I'm going to take care of my family at the same time of not having a job.
Yeah.
The second one really has to do with people. I came to the conclusion that without knowing why, the early part of my career when I was a manager went really well because I really had a people focus, and I decided servant leadership was the way I was going to approach business. So if I was in charge, my goal was to make the job of the people that work for me easier and not vice versa. Don't make them guess about me and have to serve me and figure out what they're doing with me to get ahead. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do was coach them and mentor them, give them feedback, give them attaboys, and put them in a situation that they can start to make decisions and they don't have to worry about me looking over their shoulders. Mm. And I had kind of done that at the beginning of my career by instinct, and later in my career, in this period of time after I went back to Sprint when I was in my 40s, I said, I need to get back to that. I need to do it more purposefully. I wasn't doing it as purposefully as I could, which meant that sometimes I didn't do it as well as I should because I wasn't paying as much attention. I was just letting it happen. And I think that comes from having too much success too early and getting too full of yourself. And the lesson there was straight talk with yourself. Make sure you are very vulnerable when needed, because people will accept that. Yeah. If you let them know why and how you make mistakes and that you take responsibility for mistakes. And so that second wave of my career really came from a lot of looking back and the perspective that I had on the early part, when I didn't quite know what I was doing, but it was working because I was just using instincts. Mm-hmm. And later on, I did it more purposefully.
No, I like that. I like that. So a lot more self-awareness, it sounds like, you know, after going through that. I think that's a crucial part of being a leader, is to understand what's it like to be on the other side of you.
Yes. And if you really take the last 4 or 5 minutes we've talked about this and you encapsulate it, you would probably come to the conclusion, as I have, that the massive failure and the issues that I had in the 36 to 40 year old me and the jobs that I had were incredible learning experiences, personally, business-wise, and leadership-wise. We're talking leadership. I can tell you, it came out of that because I said to myself, I have to lead in three specific ways. I have to lead myself, I have to lead my people, and I have to lead my business in that order. And the first thing I need to do is figure out what it means to lead myself and be vulnerable and support people and share with them and not withhold information and coach and storytell and teach. And if I do that, what happens is I get better and better. People want to work with me and for me, and that makes the business better. Yeah. And so the first thing you have to do is get those people that you want on the bus in the right seats, and you've got it. And the next thing you do is you work with them to help run the business. So you run you lead yourself, you lead the people. And then the third one, leading the business, is the fun part. Once you've got your leadership of yourself and the people that work with you down, leading of the business is the fun part, because you're really teaming, you're communicating, you're butting heads occasionally, but you're not doing it personally. What you're doing is you're doing it for the betterment of the business.
Harry, that's really good. That's really good stuff.
Thank you.
One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is kind of a crisis in leadership right now. And I got some statistics here. It says, there's a recent study found that 40% of leaders have considered stepping down to improve their well-being. Is that something you agree with? And do you think there's other indicators of a leadership crisis?
Wow. I have no reason to disbelieve the 40%, so I'm going to say not surprised. I think in the business world, I'll call it post-World War II, the decades that have happened, we've gone through all sorts of different ups and downs of the business cycle, mainly a Northeastern march, but with some struggles along the way from an American business standpoint. But a lot of that is caused by the necessity of a new generation coming on. I have been retired for over 5 years now, so I've never really had to manage I didn't have to manage in the COVID timeframe, and I didn't have to deal as much with the work at home, which a lot of times was kind of driven by COVID, but also by the employees of the next generation. And I don't kid myself, it would have been hard. I would have been kind of teetering on the edge of, I'm the end of the baby boomer. And I would have been one of those people that expects people to come to the office. Of course you do. That's what you do. And that helps me be able to communicate with people. It helps build a culture. And so you're in a position to win in ways that are kind of, to call it old school is a little weird, but it really is from 10 years ago to 40 years ago. And it would have been very difficult for me to have translated that. I think I could have, but I would have had to work very hard. And I think the leadership crisis could be encapsulated by this generational thing, and it may be worse than ever. Maybe worse than it's ever been, not sure. I'm going to say yes, it probably is. And that's because you've got the COVID hangover that we have that had us operate in a bunch of different ways. Let's just use working in the office versus not. And then trying some people to go back to where we were. And a lot of the workers saying, whoa, I got used to working at home. I like my dog around. I don't have to commute to work. There's all sorts of positives from my standpoint, and I don't want to come back.
Yep.
And older school people like me saying, but it matters with regard to face-to-face meetings and communication and culture. So I think if there's a crisis, it's driven in some ways by the hard-headedness, and I mean that in a good way, the hard-headedness of the two generations that are now coming into the workforce. And as they become leaders, are they going to revert back to some of the older ways, or are they going to be very, very supportive of the generations that have different thoughts because of COVID and their age on how they want to operate? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, that's good insight. That's really good insight. Now, I'm going to throw out a couple more statistics here. And
okay.
I want you to just pick and choose which one you think is the most relevant. But it says that employee trust in leadership has dropped from 46% in 2022 to 29% in 2024. So the trust in our leaders in the work environment has gone down significantly. The other thing that I see is that 77% of organizations are reporting a shortage of good leaders. And right now, it's a challenge. You know, how do businesses find good leaders? How do they, you know, put people in leadership, the right people in leadership roles? How do they train these people? You know, it's a challenge. You know, there's so much to it. You know, I want to just get a little bit of your insights in that.
Let me comment on both of those. The trust one rocks me when I hear that. In the 40s down to 29% trust. And I think that is remedied by leaders taking very specific steps to not let that happen. Let me explain. I look at how the traits of a leader, and one of the most important ones is vulnerability. taking responsibility for mistakes, being willing to talk with either your leadership team or the entire organization to talk about why and how things are happening and what mistakes have been made. Not information hoarding. One of the things I was known to do was I copied a lot of people on emails when I was the president of big divisions of Sprint and Embark. I would copy a lot of people when I sent a communication out, because the more people that knew what I was thinking and why, the better it would be. Doesn't mean they have to agree with me, but they at least understand my rationale, so we don't get bogged down into the working ourselves backwards in order to go forward.
Yeah.
So I love doing stuff like that. So we're in a situation where I believe trust comes from sharing with employees, being vulnerable, and supporting them in every way you can, appropriately supporting them. And then the final word I'm going to use is consistency. I think one of the things that leaders that are coming up don't pay as much attention to now as they should and as they used to, and that's consistency. If you operate with your set of values and your rules and you march forward so that people don't worry that the rules are going to change and the boundaries are going to be malleable, I think it's much easier for people then to make a decision. It might be a decision in the moment that they're making with their group, their bosses back at headquarters, but they're not worried about it. They're not looking over their shoulder. What they're doing is they're making a decision based on their experience plus their knowledge of what the leader in the organization needs to do strategically, and we're fine. And you don't worry about the implications and repercussions of it not going correctly. I think that kind of trust is absolutely imperative to have in order to be successful in business in the short and the long term. Mm-hmm. But I think it's slipped down, and I think a lot of that is because leaders are reverting to the information hoarding phase, or you don't really need to know that, so it's not a big deal. And so they're flippantly being offhanded about it. Yeah. I think that's wrong. I think what you do is you get very purposeful with regard to your inclusion of thinking, decision-making, and consensus, and then drive forward. And I felt like if you could keep those numbers really high with regard to trust between the employees and the leadership team, you got a lot better chance to win in the business world.
Yeah. I think that's really important. I think another thing that I think about is in communication, in my leadership roles, I've learned how to, and I got this from Steve Cockrum and Jeremy Kubitschek, you know, who wrote the 100X Leader, but they have a tool called Provisional, Plan, and Promise.
Interesting.
So provisional means that, well, I'm just spitballing. I'm just talking. We don't want to take action. There's nothing there. We're just let's just talk that out. Mm-hmm. And you need to set that tone that this is provisional because you don't want somebody to run off and do something. Plan is this is the plan. You know, it's our plan. We're getting there. This is where we're at. We mm-hmm. have a plan, but things can come up. You know, a promise is, come hell or high water, this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will be there no matter what. You know, there's nothing going to stop me. And so there's in communication, there's different layers that I think is important as a leader to put out there. But having the transparency and being able to communicate well, I think that is a huge skill set to a leader. And you're absolutely right. If you're holding back and holding this information, you're not getting those other parties involved
mm-hmm.
that are very important. They can see things that you can't see. We have perception issues sometimes on projects.
Completely agree. I'll tell you something funny. This sounds a bit trite, but I think at my max, I had maybe 4,000 people in my group scattered across the United States in call centers, but also some at headquarters here in Kansas City for Sprint and then Embark. And I used to stand up on stage for a quarterly meeting, and I would tell people they needed to do things that I don't know about. And I would always kind of laugh, and they would laugh a little bit sometimes, depending on what level the person was. But I thought about this. I thought, we're a multi-billion dollar organization with tens of thousands of employees. Of course there will be things that are going to happen that I don't know about. But if I'm willing to stand up on stage and say that and tell them I'm setting them free and insist that they do it because I'm not needed all the time because they have more information than I do, it establishes the tone and the approach that you're going to take as a leader, lowers anxiety, and has people wanting and willing to charge forward and not worry so much. And one of the best things you can do as a leader is get the noise out of the system.
Yeah.
We are humans. We complain every once in a while. You want to complain about your boss. You want to complain about the vacation days you have, or you want to complain about noise that's happening with at the copy machine or something when you're trying to work. My whole goal, I called it the 95% principle, was to get 95% of your mental energy and your focus on the things that we want you to work on and you want to work on, and that's the goals from the plan that we've set. The other 5% is squawking and complaining and yelling at the dog, the work version of yelling at the dog. It happens. I would tell you it's 100%, but we're human and it's not going to happen. But if I can get to 95, I can win.
Yeah.
Because I think most organizations are somewhere in the 70%, and 30% is people standing around complaining and not working, and they're not being as productive as they can be. Leaders have the opportunity to make that go away. And that's not telling people to get to work. That's exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about. It is making sure that people know that they're supported, you've got their back, they're going to get developed, that you're going to listen to them, you're going to share with them, you're going to support them, you're going to be consistent. And if you do all that, the problem, the downtime and the wasted time and the sniping and cultural problems go away and they start to melt, and you get that 95%. If you give me 95%, I'm going to win.
I love that. I love that. Harry, I want to talk to you about leadership, leadership stories, and some of the interesting leaders that you've had the pleasure of meeting and getting to know. And you told me a great story about Sam Walton. How did you get to be around Sam Walton?
Sheer luck. It's nothing wrong with that either.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes recognizing when something is lucky is kind of cool. So I was at Procter & Gamble in marketing in 1985. I ended up staying 7 years. In the middle of that 7 years, I was asked to move to Northwest Arkansas and be the part of a customer team, first ever in the consumer packaged goods area, where we moved one person from each function of the company down to Northwest Arkansas. Each of the functions within Procter & Gamble, the people that moved down there were assigned a person within Walmart and Sam's that was their liaison, and their goal was to learn how to run the business better together, because P&G was the biggest supplier to Walmart and Sam's, and Sam's and Walmart were the biggest customer of Procter & Gamble, and they had an adversarial relationship. They decided they need to make that go away and make it much better and healthier, with the idea that the two companies would figure out how to run the business better, and then they would translate that to the competitors of Procter & Gamble. The first thing that P&G said was, wait a minute, can't this be proprietary? And Walmart said, no, we're talking about running the business. Now, you are helping to invent it, so you've got an advantage there. Plus, you're going to probably be 6 months ahead of other people. So be happy about that and make it work. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sams came up with this idea and worked with the senior people at Procter & Gamble, and they put this into place. And I was asked to move down there. And I got a chance to be around Mr. Sam for a lot of meetings and watching him. I would go on Saturday morning meetings occasionally up to Walmart. They actually have company meetings and report business results and talk about decisions, and they made them fast on Saturdays, put them into play on Mondays. I got a chance to go to a number of those Saturday morning meetings, and they were just phenomenal watching him operate. And you realized he was brilliant, and he was such a people person. It was astounding. His organization loved him. They absolutely loved him. They followed him. They believed in him. And he had the trust of the organization. It was extraordinarily fun to watch him do that. One of the cool ways I got to know him a little bit more than a lot of people that were there from P&G is that there was the Walton family gave a bunch of money to Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Arkansas matched it, and they built a performing arts center. And my wife was in charge of the groundbreaking ceremony for the Walton Arts Center, the Broadway Performing Arts Center that was in Fayetteville. And so I went to a number of different charity events where I would lean against the wall as a trailing spouse.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my gig. My wife was involved. Sam was leaning against the wall next to me because it wasn't his gig. It was his wife Helen's project she was working on. And I got a chance to talk to Mr. Sam a few different times, and he was amazing. He remembered me. I was with Procter & Gamble, and what we were doing was a pretty important and cool revolutionary approach to sales and the approach to business kind of end-to-end with regard to two wildly successful companies. So it's not surprising he knew about P&G, but it was really cool watching him and interact with people and how he led. He believed in servant leadership. It was one of the first times I'd heard somebody talk so specifically about servant leadership, because it was so important to him to make sure that the leaders were the ones that were serving their org, to make sure that the customers were then taken care of. It was 2.5 years that I spent in Northwest Arkansas living in Fayetteville and working with the Walmart folks, and it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I loved it.
Yeah. What do you think made him as such a great leader?
I'll give you the instant reaction I had. I don't know that I could have labeled it, but he had EQ and IQ. At the time, I didn't really know what that was, but I'm able to, in hindsight, look at that and say he was one of those people that was very sharp business-wise. He was a retailer. He knew his numbers. He knew his stores. He knew his customers. Very, very sharp. And at the same time, he had very calming people skills. He had high accountability with regard to himself and his people. He'd never asked anything more from them than he would from himself. And so he had this consistency, when I've talked about it before, mm-hmm. of making all of these stuff that doesn't matter go away so that you're really working on the things that do matter. And I watched that and I thought, what kind of magic is happening here? And I realized that his approach was very personal to him. It had to do with his personality, but it led to incredible leadership results because he had such a good high EQ and IQ comboed.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. I think he's a wonderful leader. He has a different style than other leaders. So if we were to talk about Jack Welch, Jack Welch is not a Sam Walton, but again, successful leader, you know. What do you think about the contrast of leaders? I mean, they're...
Could not agree more with what you just said. As a sports freak, when I was growing up in Indiana, my head basketball coach of my school, which was Indiana University, was Bob Knight.
Mm-hmm.
He had all sorts of anger issues and didn't exactly come across as warm and fuzzy, but he was extraordinary from a coaching, mentoring, and leadership standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the way he treated people occasionally and the press, not just occasionally, quite frequently. When you talk about Jack Welch, I think he was a version of Bobby Knight in the business world.
Yeah.
He didn't suffer the fools, should mm-hmm. anybody? No, but you don't have to deal with them specifically as harshly as he did, or at least I believe he did. I was never involved specifically with General Electric, but the 20 years that Jack Welch was the CEO there, they were wildly successful. I've heard Sam Walton talk about Jack Welch and say, to paraphrase him, not to quote him, Jack deals with people in the way that it matches his personality and his how he learned to be successful and the way he wanted to operate. It's not the way I would operate, and it's not the way I do operate, but it works for him and mine works for me, so to each his own. It was fascinating to think about how they weren't 180 degrees different because they were both brilliant men who had the IQ down, but they dealt with the EQ and the people side of the business so dramatically different. It was amazing.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you've written a couple books. One of them over there, if you can grab that and hold it up.
Sure.
Hold it up to the camera there, right there. Tell me about that book. What does Get Real mean?
I have written three books. I didn't mean to start out by calling them the Get Real books, but the three I have, Get Real Leadership, I followed that up with Get Real Culture, and then Get Real Mindsets, my most recent one. This one, written in 2012, so it's been around a long time, is just, it's very me.
Hmm.
It's simplistic, it's 115 pages, and it's double-spaced. It's a reflection of the way I think you need to operate in order to be a successful leader, which leads to successful business, which leads to successful culture, which then leads to better business, and it's a positive cycle. I said earlier, what I believe to be a great leader needs to have three different levels of leadership, leading yourself, your people, and your business. And that's outlined in here in a way that's very simplistic and talks about how I applied that in little companies like MAI, the sports marketing firm, had 20 people. Sprint had tens of thousands. Embark had tens of thousands. And DuraVision had maybe 25. So I've been involved with and dealt with leadership at all sorts of different levels. And I love talking about how simplistic it can be. When I first... I'm hired to do keynote speeches on leadership, culture, and mindset. And when I first wrote this and would give a keynote speech, Jim, I would actually apologize for the simplicity of it, because this is dumb damn simple, this book is. And I did that not on purpose, but because that's the way I think and the way I communicate and the way I believe people can remember and drive forward to success. After I'd done a few of the speeches, and then I really paid more attention to other leadership speakers and other books, and I did some soul searching internally, I realized I'm not going to apologize for the simplicity of this. I think that's the magic behind it. It's me. That's my brand.
Yeah.
It is the way I'm going to continue to present. And so I stopped doing that, and that set me free to continue to talk about with leadership in a way that has to do with storytelling and EQ and IQ combined in order to win. One final point about this book, the subtitle is, this is a practical approach that delivers relationships, respect, and results. I heard Mr. Sam say that, and the second time I heard him say it, I said, I have to write that down. I love this. Too many people think you need to trade off the idea of being a nice person versus winning in business and making tough decisions. Mm. I think Sam Walton is a great example of someone that showed what you can do is you can put those together. You don't have to do a trade-off. You can have productive, solid relationships with people. You can show respect, two-way street with people, and you can still deliver results. Boy, did he deliver results.
Yeah.
And you can do all that together without giving up on it. And I think too many people think you can't, and they have to decide whether they're going to be either too soft or too hard But Mr. Sam, when I saw him operate and heard him talk, I think he would say, nope, you don't have to. You can actually have all these things.
I love that. I love that. Now, you said speaking. Talk to me about speaking. I think you've got an amazing speaking story because you go out and you do a lot of speaking. People love you on your website. You know, he says that he makes company meetings cool, which I think is true. I've seen you speak before. You're a wonderful speaker. But all of the money that you make speaking, you don't keep it. You give it all away. Tell me about that.
I do. This has been a journey.
Yeah.
My wife was diagnosed with a malignant, inoperable brain tumor early on in our marriage. And, wow, it was such a shock to our family. I was supporting her with words. I'm so sorry this has happened. She was asymptomatic, but she had this tumor wrapped around her motor cortex, which made it inoperable. And I got so tired of supporting her with just words, I decided I needed to do something. So about 5 years before I retired, I wrote the first book, and I started doing speeches. And I'm a storyteller. I'm a humorist a bit. I also am a person that believes in EQ and IQ. And I put all that together, and I decided I was going to start training's the wrong word. I was going to start talking to people about how and why I did what I did in case my personality and brand was similar to theirs, and then they could use it to form their own leadership principles and values. And I have such fun with this, and I do it, and what happens is I get my gross speaking fees, and I gave 100% of the gross speaking fees to headforthecure.org. So head, as in brain tumors, mm-hmm. headforthecure.org. It's a Kansas City charity organization. I'm on the board. And the whole goal of it is to find a cure for brain tumors. Mm. And so I fully support my wife in that way. I love doing it. The reason why I wrote the second and the third book is because I get people that hire me, and it works, and it goes very well. They might want to hire me again a year later or 2 years later, and I got a new topic. Next time I'm going to talk to them about mindset.
Yeah.
So I love doing it. As of today, I did the math before I came over here. I just hit $686,000 that I've raised speaking. I also give 100% of my book proceeds. The book's available on Amazon and Kindle. And I've sold over 13,000 of the three books combined. So the book proceeds and the speaking fees combined are just short of $700,000. And I'm very happy that it gives me a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
To try to help my wife, mm-hmm. and to show her that I love her without just the words, but it's also the actions.
I love that.
Thank you.
I love that.
Thanks for asking me about that. The final piece of that was my wife, Chris, sometimes laughs and says, even if I wasn't sick, so if she didn't have a brain tumor, she said, you would have done a speaking business anyway because you're a storyteller and you're a teacher and you want people to understand that from a simple standpoint, there are some basic steps you can take to become a better and better and better and better and better leader without getting all wrapped around the axle and getting too scientific or getting too fancy with it. You can just take simple steps to get better.
I love that. I love that. Now, one of the thoughts behind the name of the podcast, Speaking with Authority, it's a double entendre. And I brought you on because you're an authority on this stuff. You've got some experience. But on the other side of it, you know, leaders want to have authority when they're speaking. And sometimes leaders don't speak with authority and they don't have authority. What do you think kills a leader's influence?
The first thing that comes to mind is consistency, and I talked about that. if you, on, I've had a couple bad bosses.
Yeah.
Only, I think I've had 24 bosses. And two of them were not good. And the reason they were not good is one of them particularly was inconsistent. So on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I was considered an all-star, and she would tell me that, and she would tell me, you know, I'm going places. Then on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, if we were working, she might just as likely throw a stapler at my head and tell me I'm not good.
Hmm.
The way that manifests itself in the human body and the human intellect is you just want to stay away from it.
Yeah.
You might like the Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or the Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know that the other days that you're going to be there, you're not going to get that, you just say, I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah.
Consistency is huge. And I think it happens because people, leaders don't stop, put their feet on the ground and say, okay, how am I personally affecting the people that I work with? What do I want from them? How can I help them? How can I make them better leaders? How can I invest in them? And if you're not doing that and doing that other orientation, what can happen is you can get way too wrapped around yourself.
Yeah.
And proud of yourself. I had that period of time where I just got a little too full of myself, and I learned a harsh lesson by getting smacked down big time.
Yeah.
I think that happens too often, and when it does, it can be pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah. There's a lot of leaders out there, I think, that have a perception of what they should be doing as a leader or as a manager. So I know that I've gotten into trouble where I feel like I need to be doing something, and I need to be checking or sending out an email or, you know, giving some guidance. And sometimes that's detrimental. You know, I just need to let the team do it. You know, I don't want to distract them. I don't want to be there. But I see leaders a lot of times, and they don't have the EQ or the PQ. And what happens is it gets into a confrontational situation where the leader becomes a little dogmatic, a little too challenging. And in the person that they're leading, it creates a brain chemical called cortisol. And it creates another chemical called norepinephrine or adrenaline. And so they've got cortisol and adrenaline. And it seems to just freeze up and locks up somebody's prefrontal cortex.
Wow.
And you're needing that person to be creative. And you can't get them to be creative when you've locked up their creative part of their brain. And I don't think that is so much with the, you know, Bobby Knight might be that way. Jack Welch might be that way. Sam Walton wasn't that way. And I think that getting the best creativity out of your people, when you need them to think as a leader, you've got to have the right balance of support and challenge to liberate somebody.
I love that. While you were talking, it struck me that I have a rule for myself as a leader that one time a year, I allow myself the opportunity to use positional power.
Hmm.
I don't have to, but I can do it once a year.
Okay.
So I have to use it carefully. And positional power, your body language is saying you've got a version of what that looks like. It's the old because I said so.
Yep.
And this is a great example of how I'm kind of a storyteller. I have one. And when I tell people that, it really conjures up all sorts of interesting situations where they've had a boss, maybe it's a parent, that say, because I
said so.
I'm in charge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm it. And I say one a year. My goal is to use it zero. Because it's usually not a good situation when it happens, but if you need to have it under fire, I've got it for once a year. And it's one of my favorite things to say with people, and I tell my lead team, and the reason why I tell them is because as I'm working through the process, many times I I get positional power into the on deck circle, but don't use it. And they can see that it's coming up, and they know I've got one, and I might use it, and we're not sure. And it sounds threatening, but it's not. What it is it's very enlightening for them to understand how strongly I'm feeling about something, how I don't think something's going well, and we may need to change it or do something different. And then they'll talk to me about it. I'm willing to take more info, and you kind of lower the blood pressure, and then don't use it. But I thought you would appreciate that. One time a year, you're allowed to. I allow myself to do that.
Yeah, I like that.
With the goal of zero, but one time is possible.
That's great. You know, my that reminded me of a story. I don't know why it triggered that, but my grandfather used to tell me, he says, "Jim, I've never fired a person in my life." He said, "There are a lot of people who've chosen not to work for me, but I've never fired anybody." And he told me, he used to sit down with anybody he hired. He says, "I will never fire you. Just want you to know that. I will never fire you. But you might choose not to work here." He said, "There's going to be some actions that you take, and I'll bring those to your attention. But you're making the decision not to work here. I'm not going to fire you."
I love that.
He was brilliant. He worked with a lot of salespeople. And I really like that. It's been a good podcast with you. There's one thing that I want to ask you that I think is very, very important. You know, leadership is about influence. And it's hard to lead people when you can't influence them.
Amen.
How do people become more influential?
The reason I'm hesitating is because, truth be told, I feel like I'm being repetitive, but the answer is repetitive, so I'm going to give it to you. And I'm going backwards in my career and starting to think about when I first had people work for me, and then I first had a group that was double digits, and then they got bigger, and why and how, and how did I either have influence or deal with situations that arose, whether they were good or bad. And the two pieces that have always been my rock were, I want to be seen as a person that shares, that is vulnerable, that is open, and supportive. I want to be somebody who asks others' opinions, gathers info, looks for good decisions, if need be, make the hard ones myself, take responsibility for mistakes and failures. And then also shoot straight, and that's one that I love. Tell the truth.
Yeah.
You got a question, give an answer, tell the truth. Tell the truth, tell the truth, because people know you're straight shooters. And if you share with people, you support people, and you're a straight shooter, your influence just rockets forward. It's not that hard. Is there a book called Everything You Need to Know You Learned in Kindergarten? I think there's something from back in the day. And I love that statement, because at the end, at my core, what I believe is the things that I just mentioned are kind of boring and they're repetitive, but you know what? They work.
Yeah.
And incredibly well to raise your influence. And I love that word influence, because it doesn't mean positional power.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to translate that as a very positive word. It could be both, I guess. But at the end of the day, I think it's very positive, because if I have influence in that, what that means is I've got knowledge, and I treat people in a way that they want to interact with me, and they want to try to help me. And I have the ability then to win with them instead of through them or by myself.
I love that. That is really good. Any questions that I should have asked you about leadership that I didn't?
In the pre-work you sent me, you talked about whether leaders are born or made. And I love that. I've gotten that only a couple times in podcasts over the last 10 years. And I'll just tell you, anybody that answers that, that has to, in my mind, believe it's both. And the question is degree. I tend to be somebody that leans toward well over half can be learned, perfected, worked on, and continually improved.
Okay.
So let's call it 65%, maybe 70. The 30 or 35 is, in my mind, can be effective because it has to do with your personality.
Yeah.
And you have more of an extroversion. There are great leaders that are introverts too, but you have this people vibe about you, and you understand, and you have the EQ that says you know how to push when you need to push, support when you need to support, but you have that figured out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to land at 70-30 with 30%, I guess born with is a weird way to say it, but I'm going to say you have that as your nature and your personality and your leanings, and then 70% can be learned. Because if you don't pay attention to it and think about what your values and how you approach things and how you want to deal with people and how you want to get the results you get by to win, if you don't do that, you're going to be a little haphazard, and you might be born with 30% effectiveness as a leader, and the other 70, you only get a small portion of that because you have not paid attention to invest in yourself in a way that makes you a better leader, because I think you can do that, and it's not hard.
That's great. I think that is very good insight. You know, that's an age-old question. Is it born leaders, or is it worked at? You know, I think that there's a balance. You know, not everyone can be a leader, and you got to identify that. But it takes time and effort, and, you know, self-awareness, self-leadership is a start, and then there's an investment of learning how to be a great leader. I think that sometimes, to give an analogy, some leaders are like a fourth grade band. It's very painful to listen to, okay? But some fourth grade band members go on to play in the symphony. And a symphony is a wonderful thing to listen to. And if you think of a leader as a symphonic, you know, the opposite of a symphony is a cacophony. You know, cacophony is an opposite of a symphony. And I think that great leaders all start as a fourth grade band member. But some have the ability to become great leaders. And I think with your book and your speaking and you're out there putting yourself out there, helping people and organizations develop better leaders is a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
So I want to just thank you for being on the podcast today. And how can people get in touch with you? How can they hire you to speak?
The simplest thing is to go to my website, harryscampbell.com. My books are available on Amazon and Kindle. And I am fired up about the opportunity to be able to teach and learn and tell stories and to raise money for a cause that matters to us and gives me my sense of purpose. So double win from that standpoint. But harryscampbell.com is where you can find all sorts of stuff about me.
Awesome. Well, I'll put the link and all the information in the description on this website and on the YouTube or Spotify or wherever you're watching this or listening to it from. I just want to thank you for tuning in today. And Harry Campbell, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.